It reduced a tree to sawdust. The tree disappeared as if they had blown it away. When Moctezuma was told all this, he was terror-struck. He felt faint. His heart failed him. Reports continued to arrive. "We are not as strong as they," Moctezuma was told. "We are nothing compared to them." The Spaniards began to be called the gods come from the heavens. Nevertheless, the Aztecs had no illusions about the Spaniards, whom they described in these words. "They seized upon the gold as if they were monkeys, their faces gleaming. For clearly, their thirst for gold was insatiable. They starved for it. They lusted for it. They wanted to stuff themselves with it as if they were pigs. So they went about fingering, taking up the streamers of gold, moving them back and forth, grabbing them to themselves, babbling, talking gibberish among themselves." But their insight into the Spanish character did not help them defend themselves. In 1517, a great comet had been seen in Mexico. Moctezuma, captured by the legend of the return of the Aztec god Quetzalcoatl as a white-skinned man arriving across the eastern sea, promptly executed his astrologers. They had not predicted the comet, and they had not explained it. Certain of forthcoming disaster, Moctezuma became distant and gloomy. Aided by the superstition of the Aztecs and their own superior technology, an armed party of 400 Europeans and their native allies in the year 1521 entirely vanquished and utterly destroyed a high civilization of 1 million people. The Aztecs had never seen a horse. There were none in the New World. They had not applied iron metallurgy to warfare. They had not invented firearms. Yet the technological gap between them and the Spaniards was not very great, perhaps a few centuries. "We must be the most backward technical society in the galaxy. Any society still more backward would not have radio astronomy at all. If the doleful experience of cultural conflict on Earth were the galactic standard, it seems we would already have been destroyed," perhaps with some passing admiration expressed for Shakespeare, Bach, and Vermeer. But this has not happened. Perhaps alien intentions are uncompromisingly benign, more like La Perouse than Cortez. Or might it be, despite all the pretensions about UFOs and ancient astronauts, that our civilization has not yet been discovered? On the one hand, we have argued that if even a small fraction of technical civilizations learn to live with themselves and with weapons of mass destruction, there should now be an enormous number of advanced civilizations in the galaxy. We already have slow interstellar flight and think fast interstellar flight a possible goal for the human species. On the other hand, we maintain that there is no credible evidence for the Earth being visited now or ever. Is this not a contradiction? If the nearest civilization is, say, 200 light years away, it takes only 200 years to get from there to here at close to the speed of light. Even at 1% or 0.1% of the speed of light, beings from nearby civilizations could have come during the tenure of humanity on Earth. Why are they not here? There are many possible answers. Although it runs contrary to the heritage of Aristarchus and Copernicus, perhaps we are the first. Some technical civilization must be the first to emerge in the history of the galaxy. Perhaps we are mistaken in our belief that at least occasional civilizations avoid self-destruction. Perhaps there is some unforeseen problem to interstellar spaceflight, although at speeds much less than the velocity of light, it is difficult to see what such an impediment might be. Or perhaps they are here, but in hiding because of some lex galactica, some ethic of non-interference with emerging civilizations. We can imagine them, curious and dispassionate, observing us as we would watch a bacterial culture in a dish of agar to determine whether this year again we managed to avoid self-destruction. But there is another explanation that is consistent with everything we know. If a great many years ago, an advanced interstellar spacefaring civilization emerged 200 light years away, it would have no reason to think there was something special about the Earth, unless it had been here already. No artifact of human technology, not even our radio transmissions, has had time, even traveling at the speed of light, to go 200 light years. From their point of view, all nearby star systems are more or less equally attractive for exploration or colonization. There may be many motivations to go to the stars. If our sun or a nearby star were about to go supernova, a major program of interstellar spaceflight might suddenly become attractive. If we were very advanced, the discovery that the galactic core was imminently to explode might even generate serious interest in transgalactic or intergalactic spaceflight. Such cosmic violence occurs sufficiently often that nomadic spacefaring civilizations may not be uncommon. Even so, their arrival here remains unlikely. An emerging technical civilization, after exploring its home planetary system and developing interstellar spaceflight, would slowly and tentatively begin exploring the nearby stars. Some stars would have no suitable planets. Perhaps they would all be giant gas worlds or tiny asteroids. Others would carry an entourage of suitable planets, but some would already be inhabited, or the atmosphere would be poisonous, or the climate uncomfortable. In many cases, the colonists might have to change, or, as we would parochially say, terraform a world to make it adequately clement. The re-engineering of a planet will take time. Occasionally, an already suitable world would be found and colonized. The utilization of planetary resources so that new interstellar spacecraft could be constructed locally would be a slow process. Eventually, a second generation mission of exploration and colonization would take off toward stars where no one had yet been. And in this way, a civilization might slowly wend its way like a vine among the worlds. It is possible that at some later time, with third and higher orders of colonies developing new worlds, another independent, expanding civilization would be discovered. Very likely, mutual contact would already have been made by radio or other remote means. The new arrivals might be a different sort of colonial society. Conceivably, two expanding civilizations with different planetary requirements would ignore each other, their filigree patterns of expansion intertwining, but not conflicting. They might cooperate in the exploration of a province of the galaxy. Even nearby civilizations could spend millions of years in such separate or joint colonial ventures without ever stumbling upon our obscure solar system. No civilization can possibly survive to an interstellar spacefaring phase unless it limits its numbers. Any society with a marked population explosion will be forced to devote all its energies and technological skills to feeding and caring for the population on its home planet. This is a very powerful conclusion and is in no way based on the idiosyncrasies of a particular civilization. On any planet, no matter what its biology or social system, an exponential increase in population will swallow every resource. Conversely, any civilization that engages in serious interstellar exploration and colonization must have exercised zero population growth or something very close to it for many generations. But a civilization with a low population growth rate will take a long time to colonize many worlds, even if the strictures on rapid population growth are eased after reaching some lush Eden. My colleague, William Newman, and I have calculated that if a million years ago, a spacefaring civilization with a low population growth rate emerged 200 light years away and spread outward, colonizing suitable worlds along the way, their survey starships would be entering our solar system only about now. But a million years is a very long period of time. If the nearest civilization is younger than this, they would not have reached us yet. A sphere 200 light years in radius contains 200,000 suns and perhaps a comparable number of worlds suitable for colonization. It is only after 200,000 other worlds have been colonized that, in the usual course of things, our solar system would be accidentally discovered to to harbor an indigenous civilization. What does it mean for a civilization to be 1 million years old? We have had radio telescopes and spaceships for a few decades. Our technical civilization is a few hundred years old. Scientific ideas of a modern cast, a few thousand. Civilization in general, a few tens of thousands of years. Human beings evolved on this planet only a few 1 million years ago. At anything like our present rate of technical progress, an advanced civilization millions of years old is as much beyond us as we are beyond a bush baby or a macaque. Would we even recognize its presence? Would a society 1 million years in advance of us be interested in colonization or interstellar spaceflight? People have a finite lifespan for a reason. Enormous progress in the biological and medical sciences might uncover that reason and lead to suitable remedies. Could it be that we are so interested in spaceflight because it is a way of perpetuating ourselves beyond our own lifetimes? Might a civilization composed of essentially immortal beings consider interstellar exploration fundamentally childish? It may be that we have not been visited because the stars are strewn abundantly in the expanse of space, so that before a nearby civilization arrives, it has altered its exploratory motivations or evolved into forms indetectable to us. A standard motif in science fiction and UFO literature assumes extraterrestrials roughly as capable as we. Perhaps they have a different sort of spaceship or ray gun, but in battle, and science fiction loves to portray battles between civilizations, they and we are rather evenly matched. In fact, there is almost no chance that two galactic civilizations will interact at the same level. In any confrontation, one will always utterly dominate the other. 1 million years is a great many. If an advanced civilization were to arrive in our solar system, there would be nothing whatever we could do about it. Their science and technology would be far beyond ours. It is pointless to worry about the possible malevolent intentions of an advanced civilization with whom we might make contact. It is more likely that the mere fact they have survived so long means they have learned to live with themselves and others. Perhaps our fears about extraterrestrial contact are merely a projection of our own backwardness, an expression of our guilty conscience about our past history, the ravages that have been visited on civilizations only slightly more backward than we. We remember Columbus and the Arawaks, Cortez and the Aztecs, even the fate of the Tlingit in the generations after La Perouse. We remember and we worry. But if an interstellar armada appears in our skies, I predict we will be very accommodating. A very different kind of contact is much more likely. The case we have already discussed, in which we receive a rich, complex message, probably by radio, from another civilization in space, but do not make, at least for a while, physical contact with them. In this case, there is no way for the transmitting civilization to know whether we have received the message. If we find the contents offensive or frightening, we are not obliged to reply. But if the message contains valuable information, the consequences for our own civilization will be stunning. Insights on alien science and technology, art, music, politics, ethics, philosophy, and religion, and most of all, a profound deprovincialization of the human condition. We will know what else is possible. Because we will share scientific and mathematical insights with any other civilization, I believe that understanding the interstellar message will be the easiest part of the problem. Convincing the U.S. Congress and the Council of Ministers of the USSR to fund a search for extraterrestrial intelligence is the hard part. In fact, it may be that civilizations can be divided into two great categories. One, in which the scientists are unable to convince non-scientists to authorize a search for extraplanetary intelligence in which energies are directed exclusively inward, in which conventional perceptions remain unchallenged and society falters and retreats from the stars, and another category in which the grand vision of contact with other civilizations is shared widely and a major search is undertaken. This is one of the few human endeavors where even a failure is a success. If we were to carry out a rigorous search for extraterrestrial radio signals encompassing millions of stars and heard nothing, we would conclude that galactic civilizations were, at best, extremely rare, a calibration of our place in the universe. It would speak eloquently of how rare are the living things of our planet, and would underscore, as nothing else in human history has, the individual worth of every human being. If we were to succeed, the history of our species and our planet would be changed forever. It would be easy for extraterrestrials to make an unambiguously artificial interstellar message. For example, the first 10 prime numbers, numbers divisible only by themselves and by one, are 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, 23. It is extremely unlikely that any natural physical process could transmit radio messages containing prime numbers only. If we received such a message, we would deduce a civilization out there that was at least fond of prime numbers. But the most likely case is that interstellar communication will be a kind of palimpsest, like the palimpsests of ancient writers, short of papyrus or stone, who superimposed their messages on top of pre-existing messages. Perhaps at an ancient frequency or a faster timing, there would be another message which would turn out to be a primer, an introduction to the language of interstellar discourse. The primer would be repeated again and again because the transmitting civilization would have no way to know when we tuned in on the message. And then, deeper in the palimpsest, underneath the announcement signal and the primer, would be the real message. Radio technology permits that message to be inconceivably rich. Perhaps when we tuned in, we would find ourselves in the midst of volume 3267 of the Encyclopedia Galactica. We would discover the nature of other civilizations. There would be many of them, each composed of organisms astonishingly different from anything on this planet. They would view the universe somewhat differently. They would have different arts and social functions. They would be interested in things we never thought of. By comparing our knowledge with theirs, we would grow immeasurably. And with our newly acquired information sorted into a computer memory, we would be able to see which sort of civilization lived where in the galaxy. Imagine a huge galactic computer, a repository, more or less up to date, of information on the nature and activities of all the civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy, a great library of life in the cosmos. Perhaps among the contents of the Encyclopedia Galactica will be a set of summaries of such civilizations, the information enigmatic, tantalizing, evocative, even after we succeed in translating it. Eventually, taking as much time as we wished, we would decide to reply. We would transmit some information about ourselves, just the basics at first, as the start of a long interstellar dialogue, which we would begin, but which, because of the vast distances of interstellar space and the finite velocity of light, would be continued by our remote descendants. And someday, on a planet of some far distant star, a being very different from any of us would request a printout from the latest edition of the Encyclopedia Galactica and acquire a little information about the newest society to join the community of galactic civilizations. Chapter 13. Who Speaks for Earth? To what purpose should I trouble myself in searching out the secrets of the stars, having death or slavery continually before my eyes? A question put to Pythagoras by Anaximenes, circa 600 BC, according to Montaigne. How vast those orbs must be, and how inconsiderable this earth, the theater upon which all our mighty designs, all our navigations, and all our wars are transacted, is when compared to them. A very fit consideration and matter of reflection for those kings and princes who sacrifice the lives of so many people only to flatter their ambition in being masters of some pitiful corner of this small spot. Christian Huygens, New Conjectures Concerning the Planetary Worlds, Their Inhabitants and Productions, circa 1690. We look back through countless millions of years and see the great will to live struggling out of the intertidal slime, struggling from shape to shape and from power to power, crawling and then walking confidently upon the land, struggling generation after generation to master the air, creeping down into the darkness of the deep. We see it turn upon itself in rage and hunger and reshape itself anew. We watch it draw nearer and more akin to us, expanding, elaborating itself, pursuing its relentless, inconceivable purpose, until at last it reaches us, and its being beats through our brains and arteries. It is possible to believe that all the past is but the beginning of a beginning, and that all that is and has been is but the twilight of the dawn. It is possible to believe that all that the human mind has ever accomplished is but the dream before the awakening. Out of our lineage, minds will spring that will reach back to us in our littleness to know us better than we know ourselves. A day will come, one day in the unending succession of days, when beings who are now latent in our thoughts and hidden in our loins, shall stand upon this earth as one stands upon a footstool, and shall laugh and reach out their hands amidst the stars. H.G. Wells, The Discovery of the Future, Nature, Volume 65, page 326, 1902. The cosmos was discovered only yesterday. For a million years, it was clear to everyone that there were no other places than the Earth. Then, in the last 0.1% of the lifetime of our species, in the instant between Aristarchus and ourselves, we reluctantly noticed that we were not the center and purpose of the universe, but rather lived on a tiny and fragile world, lost in immensity and eternity, drifting in a great cosmic ocean dotted here and there with 100 billion galaxies and 1 billion trillion stars. We have bravely tested the waters and have found the ocean to our liking, resonant with our nature. Something in us recognizes the cosmos as home. We are made of stellar ash. Our origin and evolution have been tied to distant cosmic events. The exploration of the cosmos is a voyage of self-discovery. As the ancient mythmakers knew, we are the children equally of the sky and the earth. In our tenure on this planet, we have accumulated dangerous evolutionary baggage, hereditary propensities for aggression and ritual, submission to leaders and hostility to outsiders, which place our survival in some question. But we have also acquired compassion for others, love for our children and our children's children, a desire to learn from history, and a great, soaring, passionate intelligence, the clear tools for our continued survival and prosperity. Which aspects of our nature will prevail is uncertain, particularly when our vision and understanding and prospects are bound exclusively to the earth, or worse, to one small part of it. But up there, in the immensity of the cosmos, an inescapable perspective awaits us. There are not yet any obvious signs of extraterrestrial intelligence, and this makes us wonder whether civilizations like ours always rush implacably headlong toward self-destruction. National boundaries are not evident when we view the Earth from space. Fanatical ethnic or religious or national chauvinisms are a little difficult to maintain when we see our planet as a fragile blue crescent fading to become an inconspicuous point of light against the bastion and citadel of the stars. Travel is broadening. There are worlds on which life has never arisen. There are worlds that have been charred and ruined by cosmic catastrophes. We are fortunate. We are alive. We are powerful. The welfare of our civilization and our species is in our hands. If we do not speak for Earth, who will? If we are not committed to our own survival, who will be? The human species is now undertaking a great venture that, if successful, will be as important as the colonization of the land or the descent from the trees. We are haltingly, tentatively breaking the shackles of Earth, metaphorically, in confronting and taming the admonitions of those more primitive brains within us, physically, in voyaging to the planets and listening for the messages from the stars. These two enterprises are linked indissolubly. Each, I believe, is a necessary condition for the other. But our energies are directed far more toward war. Hypnotized by mutual mistrust, almost never concerned for the species or the planet, the nations prepare for death. Because what we are doing is so horrifying, we tend not to think of it much. But what we do not consider, we are unlikely to put right. Every thinking person fears nuclear war, and every technological state plans for it. Everyone knows it is madness, and every nation has an excuse. There is a dreary chain of causality. The Germans were working on the bomb at the beginning of World War II, so the Americans had to make one first. If the Americans had one, the Soviets had to have one, and then the British, the French, the Chinese, the Indians, the Pakistanis. By the end of the 20th century, many nations had collected nuclear weapons. They were easy to devise. Fissionable material could be stolen from nuclear reactors. Nuclear weapons became almost a home handicraft industry. The conventional bombs of World War II were called blockbusters. Filled with 20 tons of TNT, they could destroy a city block. All the bombs dropped on all the cities in World War II amounted to some 2 million tons, 2 megatons of TNT. Coventry and Rotterdam, Dresden and Tokyo, all the death that rained from the skies between 1939 and 1945, 100,000 blockbusters, 2 megatons. By the late 20th century, 2 megatons was the energy released in the explosion of a single, more or less humdrum, thermonuclear bomb. One bomb with the destructive force of the Second World War. But there are tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. By the ninth decade of the 20th century, the strategic missile and bomber forces of the Soviet Union and the United States were aiming warheads at over 15,000 designated targets. No place on the planet was safe. The energy contained in these weapons, genies of death, patiently awaiting the rubbing of the lamps, was far more than 10,000 megatons. But with the destruction concentrated efficiently, not over 6 years, but over a few hours, a blockbuster for every family on the planet, a World War II every second for the length of a lazy afternoon. The immediate causes of death from nuclear attack are the blast wave, which can flatten heavily reinforced buildings many kilometers away, the firestorm, the gamma rays, and the neutrons, which effectively fry the insides of passersby. A schoolgirl who survived the American nuclear attack on Hiroshima, the event that ended the Second World War, wrote this firsthand account. Through a darkness like the bottom of hell, I could hear the voices of the other students calling for their mothers. And at the base of the bridge, inside a big cistern that had been dug out there, was a mother weeping, holding above her head a naked baby that was burned bright red all over its body. And another mother was crying and sobbing as she gave her burned breast to her baby. In the cistern, The students stood with only their heads above the water and their two hands, which they clasped as they imploringly cried and screamed, calling for their parents. But every single person who passed was wounded, all of them, and there was no one to turn to for help. And the singed hair on the heads of the people was frizzled and whitish and covered with dust. They did not appear to be human, not creatures of this world. The Hiroshima explosion, unlike the subsequent Nagasaki explosion, was an airburst high above the surface, so the fallout was insignificant. But on March 1, 1954, a thermonuclear weapons test at Bikini in the Marshall Islands detonated at higher yield than expected. A great radioactive cloud was deposited on the tiny atoll of Rongelap, 150 kilometers away, where the inhabitants likened the explosion to the sun rising in the west. A few hours later, radioactive ash fell on Rongelap like snow. The average dose received was only about 175 rads, a little less than half the dose needed to kill an average person. Being far from the explosion, not many people died. Of course, the radioactive strontium they ate was concentrated in their bones, and the radioactive iodine was concentrated in their thyroids. Two-thirds of the children and one-third of the adults later developed thyroid abnormalities, growth retardation, or malignant tumors. In compensation, the Marshall Islanders received expert medical care. The yield of the Hiroshima bomb was only 13 kilotons, the equivalent of 13,000 tons of TNT. The Bikini test yield was 15 megatons. In a full nuclear exchange, in the paroxysm of thermonuclear war, the equivalent of 1 million Hiroshima bombs would be dropped all over the world. At the Hiroshima death rate of some 100,000 people killed per equivalent 13 kiloton weapon, this would be enough to kill 100 billion people. But there were less than 5 billion people on the planet in the late 20th century. Of course, in such an exchange, not everyone would be killed by the blast and the firestorm, the radiation, and the fallout. Although fallout does last for a longish time. 90% of the strontium-90 will decay in 96 years. 90% of the cesium-137 in 100 years. 90% of the iodine-131 in only a month. The survivors would witness more subtle consequences of the war. A full nuclear exchange would burn the nitrogen in the upper air, converting it to oxides of nitrogen, which would in turn destroy a significant amount of the ozone in the high atmosphere, emitting an intense dose of solar ultraviolet radiation. The increased ultraviolet flux would last for years. It would produce skin cancer, preferentially in light-skinned people. Much more important, it would affect the ecology of our planet in an unknown way. Ultraviolet light destroys crops. Many microorganisms would be killed. We do not know which ones or how many or what the consequences might be. The organisms killed might, for all we know, be at the base of a vast ecological pyramid, at the top of which totter we. The dust put into the air in a full nuclear exchange would reflect sunlight and cool the earth a little. Even a little cooling can have disastrous agricultural consequences. Birds are more easily killed by radiation than insects. Plagues of insects and consequent further agricultural disorders are a likely consequence of nuclear war. There is also another kind of plague to worry about. The plague bacillus is endemic all over the world. In the late 20th century, humans did not much die of plague, not because it was absent, but because resistance was high. However, the radiation produced in a nuclear war, among its many other effects, debilitates the body's immunological system, causing a deterioration of our ability to resist disease. In the longer term, there are mutations, new varieties of microbes and insects that might cause still further problems for any human survivors of a nuclear holocaust. And, perhaps after a while, when there has been enough time for the recessive mutations to recombine and be expressed, new and horrifying varieties of humans. Most of these mutations, when expressed, would be lethal. A few would not. And then there would be other agonies, the loss of loved ones, the legions of the burned, the blind, and the mutilated, disease, plague, long-lived radioactive poisons in the air and water, the threat of tumors and stillbirths and malformed children, the absence of medical care, the hopeless sense of a civilization destroyed for nothing, the knowledge that we could have prevented it and did not. L.F. Richardson was a British meteorologist interested in war. He wished to understand its causes. There are intellectual parallels between war and weather. Both are complex. Both exhibit regularities, implying that they are not implacable forces, but natural systems that can be understood and controlled. To understand the global weather, you must first collect a great body of meteorological data. You must discover how the weather actually behaves. Our approach must be the same, Richardson decided, if we are to understand warfare. So, for the years between 1820 and 1945, he collected data on the hundreds of wars that had been fought on our poor planet. Richardson's results were published posthumously in a book called The Statistics of Deadly Quarrels, because he was interested in how long you had to wait for a war that would claim a specified number of victims. He defined an index M, the magnitude of a war, a measure of the number of immediate deaths it causes. A war of magnitude M equals 3 might be merely a skirmish, killing only 1,000 people, 10 to the third power. M equaling 5 or M equaling 6 denote more serious wars, where 100,000, 10 to the fifth power, or 1,000,000, 10 to the sixth power, people are killed. World Wars I and II had larger magnitudes. He found that the more people killed in a war, the less likely it was to occur, and the longer before you could witness it, just as violent storms occur less frequently than cloudbursts. Richardson proposed that if you continue the curve to very small values of M, all the way to M equaling 0, it roughly predicts the worldwide incidence of murder. Somewhere in the world, someone is murdered every 5 minutes. Individual killings and wars on the largest scale are, he said, two ends of a continuum, an unbroken curve. It follows, not only in a trivial sense, but also, I believe, in a very deep psychological sense, that war is murder writ large. When our well-being is threatened, when our illusions about ourselves are challenged, we tend, some of us at least, to fly into murderous rages. And when the same provocations are applied to nation states, they too sometimes fly into murderous rages, egged on often enough by those seeking personal power or profit. But as the technology of murder improves and the penalties of war increase, a great many people must be made to fly into murderous rages simultaneously for a major war to be mustered. Because the organs of mass communication are often in the hands of the state, this can commonly be arranged. Nuclear war is the exception. It can be triggered by a very small number of people. We see here a conflict between our passions and what is sometimes called our better natures, between the deep, ancient reptilian part of the brain, the R-complex, in charge of murderous rages, and the more recently evolved mammalian and human parts of the brain, the limbic system and the cerebral cortex. When humans lived in small groups, when our weapons were comparatively paltry, even an enraged warrior could kill only a few. As our technology improved, the means of war also improved. In the same brief interval, we also have improved. We have tempered our anger, frustration, and despair with reason. We have ameliorated on a planetary scale injustices that only recently were global and endemic. But our weapons can now kill billions. Have we improved fast enough? Are we teaching reason as effectively as we can? have we courageously studied the causes of war. What is often called the strategy of nuclear deterrence is remarkable for its reliance on the behavior of our non-human ancestors. Henry Kissinger, a contemporary politician, wrote, "Deterrence depends above all on psychological criteria. For purposes of deterrence, a bluff taken seriously is more useful than a serious threat interpreted as a bluff." Truly effective nuclear bluffing, however, includes occasional postures of irrationality, a distancing from the horrors of nuclear war. Then, the potential enemy is tempted to submit on points of dispute rather than unleash a global confrontation, which the aura of irrationality has made plausible. The chief danger of adopting a credible pose of irrationality is that to succeed in the pretense, you have to be very good. After a while, you get used to it. It becomes pretense no longer. The global balance of terror, pioneered by the United States and the Soviet Union, holds hostage the citizens of the Earth. Each side draws limits on the permissible behavior of the other. The potential enemy is assured that if the limit is transgressed, nuclear war will follow. However, the definition of the limit changes from time to time. Each side must be quite confident that the other understands the new limits. Each side is tempted to increase its military advantage, but not in so striking a way as seriously to alarm the other. Each side continually explores the limits of the other's tolerance, as in flights of nuclear bombers over the Arctic wastes, the Vietnam and Afghanistan wars, a few entries from a long and dolorous list. The global balance of terror is a very delicate balance. It depends on things not going wrong, on mistakes not being made, on the reptilian passions not being seriously aroused. And so, we return to Richardson. In the diagram, the solid line is the waiting time for a war of magnitude M. That is, the average time we would have to wait to witness a war that kills 10 to the M power people, where M represents the number of zeros after the 1 in our usual exponential arithmetic. Also shown as a vertical bar at the right of the diagram is the world population in recent years, which reached 1 billion people around 1835 and is now about 4.5 billion people. When the Richardson curve crosses the vertical bar, we have specified the waiting time to doomsday, how many years until the population of the Earth is destroyed in some great war. With Richardson's curve and the simplest extrapolation for the future growth of the human population, the two curves do not intersect until the 30th century or so, and doomsday is deferred. But in World War II, some 50 million military personnel and non-combatants were killed. The technology of death advanced ominously. Nuclear weapons were used for the first time. There is little indication that the motivations and propensities for warfare have diminished since, and both conventional and nuclear weaponry has become far more deadly. Thus, the top of the Richardson curve is shifting downward by an unknown amount. If its new position is somewhere in the shaded region of the figure, we may have only another few decades until doomsday. A more detailed comparison of the incidence of wars before and after 1945 might help to clarify this question. It is of more than passing concern. This is merely another way of saying what we have known for decades. The development of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems will sooner or later lead to global disaster. Many of the American and European emigre scientists who developed the first nuclear weapons were profoundly distressed about the demon they had let loose on the world. They pleaded for the global abolition of nuclear weapons, but their pleas went unheeded. The prospect of a national strategic advantage galvanized both the USSR and the United States, and the nuclear arms race began. In the same period, there was a burgeoning international trade in the devastating non-nuclear weapons coyly called conventional. In the past 25 years, in dollars, corrected for inflation, the annual international arms trade has gone from $300 million to much more than $20 billion. In the years between 1950 and 1968, for which good statistics seem to be available, there were, on the average, worldwide several accidents involving nuclear weapons per year, although perhaps no more than one or two accidental nuclear explosions. The weapons establishments in the Soviet Union, the United States, and other nations are large and powerful. In the United States, they include major corporations famous for their homey domestic manufacturers. According to one estimate, the corporate profits in military weapons procurement are 30 to 50% higher than in an equally technological but competitive civilian market. Cost overruns in military weapons systems are permitted on a scale that would be considered unacceptable in the civilian sphere. In the Soviet Union, the resources, quality, attention, and care given to military production is in striking contrast to the little left for consumer goods. According to some estimates, almost half the scientists and high technologists on Earth are employed full or part-time on military matters. Those engaged in the development and manufacture of weapons of mass destruction are given salaries, perquisites of power, and where possible, public honors at the highest levels available in their respective societies. The secrecy of weapons development, carried to especially extravagant lengths in the Soviet Union, implies that individuals so employed need almost never accept responsibility for their actions. They are protected and anonymous. Military secrecy makes the military the most difficult sector of any society for the citizens to monitor. If we do not know what they do, it is very hard for us to stop them. And with the rewards so substantial, with the hostile military establishments beholden to each other in some ghastly mutual embrace, the world discovers itself drifting toward the ultimate undoing of the human enterprise. Every major power has some widely publicized justification for its procurement and stockpiling of weapons of mass destruction, often including a reptilian reminder of the presumed character and cultural defects of potential enemies, as opposed to us stout fellows, or of the intentions of others, but never ourselves, to conquer the world. Every nation seems to have its set of forbidden possibilities, which its citizenry and adherents must not at any cost be permitted to think seriously about. In the Soviet Union, these include capitalism, God, and the surrender of national sovereignty. In the United States, socialism, atheism, and the surrender of national sovereignty. It is the same all over the world. How would we explain the global arms race to a dispassionate extraterrestrial observer? How would we justify the most recent destabilizing developments of killer satellites, particle beam weapons, lasers, neutron bombs, cruise missiles, and the proposed conversion of areas the size of modest countries to the enterprise of hiding each intercontinental ballistic missile among hundreds of decoys? Would we argue that 10,000 targeted nuclear warheads are likely to enhance the prospects for our survival? What account would we give of our stewardship of the planet Earth? We have heard the rationales offered by the nuclear superpowers. We know who speaks for the nations, but who speaks for the human species? Who speaks for Earth? About 2/3 of the mass of the human brain is in the cerebral cortex, devoted to intuition and reason. Humans have evolved gregariously. We delight in each other's company. We care for one another. We cooperate. Altruism is built into us. We have brilliantly deciphered some of the patterns of nature. We have sufficient motivation to work together and the ability to figure out how to do it. If we are willing to contemplate nuclear war and the wholesale destruction of our emerging global society, should we not also be willing to contemplate a wholesale restructuring of our societies? From an extraterrestrial perspective, our global civilization is clearly on the edge of failure in the most important task it faces: to preserve the lives and well-being of the citizens of the planet. should we not then be willing to explore vigorously, in every nation, major changes in the traditional ways of doing things? A fundamental redesign of economic, political, social, and religious institutions? Faced with so disquieting an alternative, we are always tempted to minimize the seriousness of the problem, to argue that those who worry about doomsdays are alarmists, to hold that fundamental changes in our institutions are impractical or contrary to human nature, as if nuclear war were practical, or as if there were only one human nature. Full-scale nuclear war has never happened. Somehow, this is taken to imply that it never will. But we can experience it only once. By then, it will be too late to reformulate the statistics. The United States is one of the few governments that actually supports an agency devoted to reversing the arms race. But the comparative budgets of the Department of Defense, $153 billion per year in 1980, and the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, $0.018 billion per year, remind us of the relative importance we have assigned to the two activities. Would not a rational society spend more on understanding and preventing than on preparing for the next war? It is possible to study the causes of war. At present, our understanding is meager, probably because disarmament budgets have, since the time of Sargon of Akkad, been somewhere between ineffective and non-existent. Microbiologists and physicians study diseases mainly to cure people. Rarely are they rooting for the pathogen. Let us study war as if it were, as Einstein aptly called it, an illness of childhood. We have reached the point where proliferation of nuclear arms and resistance to nuclear disarmament threaten every person on the planet. There are no more special interests or special cases. Our survival depends on committing our intelligence and resources on a massive scale to take charge of our own destiny, to guarantee that Richardson's curve does not veer toward destruction. We, the nuclear hostages, all the peoples of the Earth, must educate ourselves about conventional and nuclear warfare. Then, we must educate our governments. We must learn the science and technology that provide the only conceivable tools for our survival. We must be willing to challenge courageously the conventional social, political, economic, and religious wisdom. We must make every effort to understand that our fellow humans all over the world are human. Of course, such steps are difficult. But as Einstein many times replied when his suggestions were rejected as impractical or as inconsistent with human nature, what is the alternative? Mammals characteristically nuzzle, fondle, hug, caress, pet, groom, and love their young, behavior essentially unknown among the reptiles. If it is really true that the R-complex and the limbic systems live in an uneasy truce within our skulls and still partake of their ancient predilections, we might expect affectionate parental indulgence to encourage our mammalian natures and the absence of physical affection to prod reptilian behavior. There is some evidence that this is the case. In laboratory experiments, Harry and Margaret Harlow found that monkeys raised in cages and physically isolated, even though they could see, hear, and smell their simian fellows, developed a range of morose, withdrawn, self-destructive, and otherwise abnormal characteristics. In humans, the same is observed for children raised without physical affection, usually in institutions where they are clearly in great pain. The neuropsychologist James W. Prescott has performed a startling cross-cultural statistical analysis of 400 pre-industrial societies and found that cultures that lavish physical affection on infants tend to be disinclined to violence. Even societies without notable fondling of infants develop nonviolent adults, provided sexual activity in adolescence is not repressed. Prescott believes that cultures with a predisposition for violence are composed of individuals who have been deprived during at least one of two critical stages in life, infancy and adolescence, of the pleasures of the body. Where physical affection is encouraged, theft, organized religion, and invidious displays of wealth are inconspicuous. Where infants are physically punished, there tends to be slavery, frequent killing, torturing and mutilation of enemies, a devotion to the inferiority of women, and a belief in one or more supernatural beings who intervene in daily life. We do not understand human behavior well enough to be sure of the mechanisms underlying these relationships, although we can conjecture. But the correlations are significant. Prescott writes, "The percent likelihood of a society becoming physically violent if it is physically affectionate toward its infants and tolerant of premarital sexual behavior is 2%. The probability of this relationship occurring by chance is 125,000 to 1. I am not aware of any other developmental variable that has such a high degree of predictive validity. Infants hunger for physical affection. Adolescents are strongly driven to sexual activity. If youngsters had their way, societies might develop in which adults have little tolerance for aggression, territoriality, ritual, and social hierarchy. Although, in the course of growing up, the children might well experience these reptilian behaviors. If Prescott is right, in an age of nuclear weapons and effective contraceptives, child abuse and severe sexual repression are crimes against humanity. More work on this provocative thesis is clearly needed. Meanwhile, we can each make a personal and non-controversial contribution to the future of the world by hugging our infants tenderly. If the inclinations toward slavery and racism, misogyny and violence are connected, as individual character in human history as well as cross-cultural studies suggest, then there is room for some optimism. We are surrounded by recent fundamental changes in society. In the last two centuries, abject slavery, with us for thousands of years or more, has been almost eliminated in a stirring planet-wide revolution. Women, patronized for millennia, traditionally denied real political and economic power, are gradually becoming, even in the most backward societies, equal partners with men. For the first time in modern history, major wars of aggression were stopped partly because of the revulsion felt by the citizens of the aggressor nations. The old exhortations to nationalist fervor and jingoist pride have begun to lose their appeal. Perhaps because of rising standards of living, children are being treated better worldwide. In only a few decades, sweeping global changes have begun to move in precisely the directions needed for human survival. A new consciousness is developing which recognizes that we are one species. Superstition is cowardice in the face of the divine, wrote Theophrastus, who lived during the founding of the Library of Alexandria. We inhabit a universe where atoms are made in the centers of stars, where each second 1,000 suns are born, where life is sparked by sunlight and lightning in the airs and waters of youthful planets, where the raw material for biological evolution is sometimes made by the explosion of a star halfway across the Milky Way, where a thing as beautiful as a galaxy is formed 100 billion times, a cosmos of quasars and quarks, snowflakes and fireflies, where there may be black holes and other universes and extraterrestrial civilizations whose radio messages are at this moment reaching the Earth. How pallid by comparison are the pretensions of superstition and pseudoscience. How important it is for us to pursue and understand science, that characteristically human endeavor. Every aspect of nature reveals a deep mystery and touches our sense of wonder and awe. Theophrastus was right. Those afraid of the universe as it really is, those who pretend to non-existent knowledge and envision a cosmos centered on human beings, will prefer the fleeting comforts of superstition. They avoid rather than confront the world. but those with the courage to explore the weave and structure of the cosmos, even where it differs profoundly from their wishes and prejudices, will penetrate its deepest mysteries. There is no other species on Earth that does science. It is, so far, entirely a human invention, evolved by natural selection in the cerebral cortex for one simple reason.